I have 9 o'clock on my watch, so let us begin. This is the let me get the date here. It's March 11th, 2019. This is the sixth of the classes on the Aruch Shulchan, and we're going to conclude with this. I want to get right to it. I have some things I want to talk about, but I'll save that to the end. Although I just want to quickly add, because it was relevant to last class and two of you emailed me, I mentioned about the Esrog farm, and two of you emailed me the article in Tablet, and I thank you for that because I actually was misinformed. I thought that the farm was actually in Dallas, and from this article, I see that Zadie Ruvain's Esrog farm is merely the distributor, or was the distributor. I looked on. The website's down, so I think it's no longer in operation. But they would buy the Esrogim from this man in California named Kirkpatrick. So thank you for that. And also with regard to Esrogim, I thank David Kessler for the following. I mentioned the Corfu Esrogim. Originally, I had written an article on the Esrogim of Corfu, and I said in the article, which is what you'll find everywhere, that Esrogim were made in, were produced, I don't know if that's the right word, were grown in Corfu, as well as other places in that area. However, before going to Corfu last summer with my group, I did a lot of research, and I found that in the mid-19th century, when the dispute was going on, the great dispute over the Esrogim on Corfu, there were actually no Esrogim grown in Corfu. The Rav of Corfu says explicitly that they're called Esrogim of Corfu because they are brought from other places and shipped from Corfu. And that continued through the rest of the 19th century. However, David Kessler asked me, am I sure this was never the case? And I said, as far as I know, this is the situation, but he brought me evidence, which I think I need to go back to my original supposition, that earlier than, yes, he says it's true that by the mid-19th century there were no Esrogim in Corfu, but he has a statement from a Rav Chaim Margolis, which is quoted by the Rav of Corfu, which speaks of Esrogim actually being grown on Corfu. So I'm not sure. I have to do more investigation. What happened between the end of the 18th century, earlier, the beginning of the 19th century, when apparently it seems there were Esrogim actually grown in Corfu, and by the mid-19th century when there were no more Esrogim? The Esrogim came from three places, not that far from Corfu, and then they were brought to Corfu, and they were shipped from there, and they were under the hashgacha of the Rav of Corfu. And I compared this to Genoa, the Yanover Esrogim, where they weren't actually grown there, but they were called that because they were shipped there. Now, at the end of the class, I'm going to talk about, I have another comment I want to say about Rabbi Zilberstein. And at least one of you wanted me to say something about what's the craziness going on in England now. So if I remember, I'll say something. But let's get right to the where we have to do be, though, and that's with the Aruch HaShulchan. In addition to what we've been speaking about, his writings, the Aruch HaShulchan, the Aruch HaShulchan HaAtid, other things, he wrote a few other works. For example, he has a commentary on the Haggadah of Pesach, which incidentally mentions a few Kabbalistic matters, and it's something you might not expect from a Lithuanian Torah scholar. He wrote a commentary, a short commentary on the Talmud Yerushalmi. You can find it in a book that's called Hashlamot Yerushalmi, which has some different commentaries to the Yerushalmi. They're not really big enough for their own volume, so they put them together. There is also a volume he wrote of Drashot, published only in 1991, called Kol Ben Levi, and this is published in the same volume as the Aruch HaShulchan, a section, a long-lost section of it on Nedarim and Shvuot, was published also in 1991. Believe it or not, published by the man whose name I mentioned a few times, Simcha Fishbein, the one who wrote the book, the short book on the Aruch HaShulchan that we'll deal with again today. Now, as a great posek, and Moshe from Lakewood has asked me this a couple of times already, as a great posek, you would expect the Aruch HaShulchan to do what poskim generally do, namely write responsa. If you look at the great poskim, they're known for their responsa. And it's not that they set out to be a respondent, if I can use that term. It's that people write to them And then they send response, and then they publish the response, and that makes them, the term is meshivim. And yet, that's not the case for the Aruch HaShulchan. First of all, he never published any responsa. And we have to explain, I think, why not. Not only did he not publish it, he didn't write responsa to any large measure. Now, if you think about the one we've been comparing the Aruch HaShulchan to a great deal, namely the Chafetz Chaim, the Mishneh Berurah, there's a parallel here because the Chafetz Chaim also did not write responsa. We don't have a collection of the Chafetz Chaim's responsa, and it's not just we don't have a collection of his responsa, he did not write responsa. I don't know what this means. If people didn't write to the Chafetz Chaim, you'd assume they would be writing to the Chafetz Chaim, but we don't have any collections of letters of his. I'm assuming that the people who wrote to him, he would write back and saying that I'm not, either if he wrote back, he'd say, I'm not someone, you have to ask your local Rav or something like that. But the Aruch HaShulchan was a communal Rav. So what's going on here? Well, Henkin discusses this as well. And he doesn't really know what to make of it. It remains a mystery. He tells us, and he's correct in this, that clearly the Aruch HaShulchan did not think this was important. The proof of this is that he did not even keep copies of the tshuvot he sent. Everyone who plans on being a meshiv and publishing his responsa keeps copies of what they sent. He did not keep copies of it. I'm thinking that perhaps the word got out that he was not interested in writing tshuvot. His focus was on writing a code. And, people send questions because they want the answer, and they don't just want a yes or no answer. They want a responsum, and usually these responsums take a long time, many hours to write. And if the word gets out, which I think it did, Henkin doesn't say this, but this is my assumption, that the Aruch HaShulchan is not interested in writing responsa, no one's going to write to him. Because again, they're writing to him. These are other Talmudic scholars writing. First of all, they don't just want a yes or no answer. Part of the responsa is that they present their approach and they want the respondent to engage with their writing. And if the word gets out that the Aruch HaShulchan or the Chafetz Chaim for that matter don't answer responsa, don't answer letters, don't write responsa, then that'll dry up. I mean, just think about Rav Moshe Feinstein. If Rav Moshe Feinstein declared or it became known that he was not going to be answering tshuvot, people would not write to him. That's the only way I can explain it. However, we do have some letters which can be categorized as responsa. With the Chafetz Chaim, I don't know offhand of any. I can't even think offhand. I can't say I've investigated this, but I can't think of any offhand, really, any letters of his which are classic responsa. I have to look again in the Mikvei Chafetz Chaim to see if there are any. He has letters, of course, but in the classic responsa, maybe he has a couple, but he's not obviously known as an author of tshuvot. We do have some from the Aruch HaShulchan, and this was put together in this volume. It's a thick volume, but most of this is not the responsa. The first, well, about half of it are letters. He divides it here, the editor, into letters, into what he calls likutim, and then he has sections of the Shulchan Aruch. So I'll show you how thick it is. Pretty thick. I mean, enough to be one volume had he written it himself. Here it is, how thick it is. So the first part is the commentary. Well, I'll tell you how many pages exactly it is. 198 pages. That's a good number for certainly for one volume. The first section is his work Or Ha'Yesharim on the Sefer Ha'Yashar of Rabbeinu Tam. Then comes the response. Also included among those are the approbations, the Haskamot. So we have to remove some pages from that. So let me speak a little bit about this volume, which has also a very nice introduction. This introduction has been superseded by everything the late Rabbi Eitan Henkin wrote, but it does mention some of the people who received smicha from him, including Rav Kook, Rav Henkin, Rav Abramsky, Rav Zevin, Rav Kahaneman. One of you emailed me when I said last class that Rav Kahaneman was one of the people, both Rav Kahaneman, the other was Rav Greineman, the nephew of the Chazon Ish, were two of the people who, I believe it's the nephew, were two of the people who said that the Aruch HaShulchan is not accepted. One of you pointed out that that's very strange because Rav Kahaneman was himself a musmach, of the Aruch HaShulchan. Again, where I got this from is from Rav Ratzabi, in response to my letter, and this appears in his Olat Yitzchak, and he's stating it as if he knows it as a fact that Rav Kahneman says that Halacha Lamaisa, the Aruch HaShulchan is someone that we don't really rely on in many areas. Another who received smicha from the Aruch HaShulchan was Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer. What people don't realize, and which was not pointed out in the introduction to the book here, is that the only smicha Rav Kook ever received was from the Aruch HaShulchan. If you recall the classes on Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer was already a great Talmud Chacham Rosh Yeshiva, but when he wanted to become Rav of the city, he needed a smicha in Slutsk. Now, the editor of this volume is a very nice fellow who I know. His name is Yehuda Horowitz. Just to give you a little bit of background, who Yehuda Horowitz is, if I'm not mistaken, he was a chazan in Riverdale for a while. But Yehuda Horowitz is the son of Baruch Horowitz, Rabbi Baruch Horowitz, the founder of the Yeshiva Dvar Yerushalayim in Yerushalayim. And actually, it's a Haredi family, but it's a great irony because Baruch Horowitz is the grandson of Rav Marcus Horowitz, that's Mordechai Horowitz, the Matei Levi, the communal Rav of Frankfurt, who was, I guess, more of the, like the modern type of Orthodox. That's the Gemeinde who were in opposition to the Hirschians, who were more extreme. And the great irony, I heard this, I think, from either Yehuda Horowitz or Mordechai Breuer, the great irony was that in Israel, the Breuers became more moderate, more Zionistic, and even though they came from an extreme background, the Hirschian background, and the descendants of the Matei Levi became more Haredi. Mordechai Horowitz, who we should do classes on, was one of the so-called protest rabbiner who signed the letter against Zionism. And yet many of his descendants ended up in Eretz Yisrael. Yehuda Horowitz has published a number of Torah articles. He published his great-great-grandfather, I think that's right, or is a great, the Matei Levi's father-in-law was the Aruch HaNer, Yaakov Ettlinger, so I guess that would make his great, I think it's the great-great-grandfather, we have to figure it out. So he published a very nice edition of the Tshuva to the Binyan Sion, as well as other stuff. And then he published this. The last time I saw him was a few years ago in Munich. He's serving, or he was serving as of a few years ago, as the assistant rabbi in Munich. And he tells us, and he did a very nice job here, gathering from all over the different letters, from manuscripts, collections at places, and from published material. And he tells us in the introduction that he went to Rav Chaim Kanievsky, that's where everyone goes for in the Lithuanian yeshiva world. And his question was, should he print all the tshuvot that he found, or should he leave? Actually, should he print all the tshuvot? That's the question. Now, why would this even be included? He doesn't tell us why. He doesn't tell us why he had this question and what he had in mind. And I mean, why would anyone even have, as we say, Talmudic Yahavamina, a thought to leave something out? If the Aruch HaShulchan wrote it, it's obviously precious, and you want to publish it. But I didn't ask Yehuda Horowitz. I should have asked him, but I don't feel I need to ask him because I know exactly what he's referring to. Namely, there's one responsum that's found number seven in here. And that deals with electricity on Yom Tov. So when Reb Chaim Kanievsky tells him he has to print everything, he's telling him you even have to print the tshuva on electricity on Yom Tov. And the fear, of course, is that because of the Aruch HaShulchan's conclusion in this responsum, it could lead people astray. Let's put it that way. So let me tell you about this this letter. It is a, it's, I guess it's a responsum. It's published here in number seven, Siman Zion. It originally appeared in a Torah journal that appeared in New York called Beis Vadel Chachamim, Year One, Issue One, in 1903. How'd the letter get there? Because someone asked the Aruch HaShulchan, and then it appeared there. And he's asked about a new phenomenon, that namely electricity, not on Shabbos, but on Yom Tov. And he concludes that it is permissible. This is a position that was very widely taken among Sephardic rabbinic authorities. On the trip to Morocco this summer, I'll speak about this because the standard view in Morocco was to turn on lights. And even in Israel, when Rav Mesas and the other Moroccan rabbi says that our practice is not to in Israel, but if you feel connected to this practice, you still can. And there's an emergency, you can. But in general, they said in Israel, the minhag is not to, so let's not. But Rav Avadia Yosef even says that although you should not turn electricity on Yom Tov, if someone does it, then it's a big deal to them. You don't need to rebuke them. So what's the reason you can turn on electricity on Yom Tov? He says that the fire, electricity is fire, and I mean it's considered ash. And inside the, he says that when you connect the positive and the negative, and how it was explained to him, the fire comes out. But you're not creating fire. The fire is actually already there, and you're just letting it come out. So, like, think of when you turn a light, the electricity is passing there, and you're not actually creating anything. You're just causing it to pass. And then he says later on, even if you tell me that you're creating light, it's you're creating the light. That is, he's not just speaking about electricity. He's speaking about turning on lights. Even if you tell me that you're actually creating this, not just transferring. It's not like when you talk about transferring, think about a match. We know that you can light it, have a lit match, and then you can transfer it to another match. So that's the first the heter. But then he says, even if you're creating it from scratch, he says that asiyah hu da'asur, creating is asur, gromos shari, gromos permitted. And he sees that all you do when you flick it to open it, that's just a gromo, and therefore will not be forbidden. And then he ends, came near on use deity, so it appears to me, lafi electric. According to my understanding of how electricity works, he says it's not found in most cities, and I can't, investigate it. I don't know whether it was found in Nevada. My impression here is it's not, because he says not found in most places, so that I could learn about it and examine it. And in the note right on this tshuva here, the editor says, see Reb Chaim Moser Grudzinski, who says it's forbidden from the Torah, and also the Beis Yitzchak, that's Reb Yitzchak Shmalkus, and other poskim, they all say it's forbidden. And then he says, apparently, the Aruch HaShulchan permitted it because he did not really understand how electricity works, and he didn't really investigate it, because as he says at the end, he couldn't investigate it because it wasn't found in his areas. I guess, I mean, you could read about it, you could ask people, but I guess seeing is better than reading about it. So that's the famous responsum of the Aruch HaShulchan, that it's that thankfully now we have it in print and you can see it. And look, I don't know really the science of this. I can tell you that in the Ashkenazic world, this view has not been accepted, but there were many great authorities in the Sephardic world. And especially if you tell me that it's ash, it's fire, it's not so simple to understand why on Yom Tov it would be forbidden, because we know that you can transfer fire from one to the other, so that what would be the problem of, I mean, think about a microwave. Also, we can cook on Yom Tov, so why couldn't you cook in a microwave? I mean, because it's the electricity. But in what way is the electricity more problematic than transferring fire? I mean, the whole idea of why it's usher is fire. If it's not fire, you could have a tearing. But we assume it's fire. Chaim Moshe Grudzinski even said you could do Havdalah on a light to make the point that it's fire. So it's not such a crazy view here that that using electricity on Yom Tov, not on Shabbos, but on Yom Tov could be permitted. But then that is not the accepted view. Although I think today still among Syrians, there are certain Syrians who still follow that old position. And there are definitely still people from Morocco. In Morocco, incidentally, the minhag was they would actually light a match on Yom Tov, which I think that I can't understand, because I mean, one of the rabbis who defended it spoke talked about like the fire being present in the match, which is clearly not the case. But okay, let's go on. Some other interesting tshuvot here. If you have the book, by the way, number 20, you can see about the Corfu etrogim. He even says that even if you're going to tell me they're kosher, how can you possibly choose them over the etrogim of Eretz Yisrael? Something he repeats in the Aruch HaShulchan as well, if you want to see this in 648 in Orach Chaim. In number 29, let me just open it here. Make sure I got the right siman. He's asked a question by this rabbi Tertius, who wrote a book. His name was Alexander Tertius. He was a big mogul in London, and he wrote a book about this the issue of mitzitza bepeh. He came up with a special kli, a utensil that allows you to do mitzitza, and he has letters from all the Lithuanian rabbanim there, including the Aruch HaShulchan, and he says that this device that you created for mitzitza. You know, is no problem. He accepts it, and I think today there's been a return from the Lithuanian world and to return among the Lithuanians back to using mezitzah bepeh, not only using it but even insisting on it, when really that was never the issue for the Lithuanians. They, in the best of all worlds, yeah, you do it with the mouth, but we know that in the 19th century, early 20th century, it was standard among Lithuanians not to do it. And not only does this book show that, but we have many other sources as well. He includes in here in the Likutim section the letters we spoke about Navardic, the defense of the Navardic students. On page 141, which is Michtavim, it's not Tshuvot. If you look at the Tshuvot, it's only about 100 pages. He says something which those historians who are listening to this will find this insightful. He's speaking about a certain issue when he says that Revitzel Chon Specter mukaf misaviv v'chule. What this means is he's surrounded by people. It's hard to, he's saying it's hard to really get it's hard to really get in to see him and speak to him. What's the issue here? Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector is the first example, really, in the Litvish world that I know of a phenomenon that which is now standard. That is the of the Askanim. You had a person named Yaakov Lifshitz, who was really the first Askan to had a stranglehold, some would say, over the Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. That is, he controlled to a certain extent. Maybe I shouldn't use the word stranglehold. People accused him of having a stranglehold, but he controlled to a certain extent the information that came in and went out from Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector. He was like his secretary. Although Rav Yitzchak Yochanan has letters in which he says, "This is my opinion. I'm not pressured by anyone." But there's a lot of complaints, especially because this Lifshitz was an anti-Zionist, and Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector was more friendly to the Zionists. But that's an interesting testimony there. Simcha Fishbein, in his book that we spoke about, deals with different themes in the book. And one of these, halachically, so let me speak about some of the themes and some of the things he says. I think it's insightful, and I accept at least some of his points. He speaks a good deal about the position of women as reflected in the Aruch HaShulchan. And paradigmatic examples, and he compares it to the Mishnah Berurah in a number of cases. So let me just share some of the things with you, which I think are of interest. On pages 21 and 22, he speaks about the women's role in cleaning for Pesach. He says the Aruch HaShulchan cites, this is what Fishbein tells us, earlier halachic sources which viewed women as lazy and simple-minded and therefore not equipped to check. That is, you can't rely on the women to do the bedikah because they're lazy and they're simple-minded. They don't set their mind to it. But what does the Aruch HaShulchan say? Today, our women inspect even better and probe after even a particle of bread, and they wash and clean every spot, and they scrutinize more than men. Fishbein sees that as an example of someone alive to the times, the Aruch HaShulchan, recognition of the change among women. If there, if, although I wonder if this was ever the case. Was it really ever the case that the women were not good cleaners? Then a second instance he gives from Pesach, and I mentioned these precisely because we're coming close to Pesach, is washing the hands at the Passover Seder. He says as follows: the head of the household should not pour for himself, but rather another should pour. For this is the expression of freedom. We're talking about washing that we all do right at the beginning of the Seder. And then he says, we're not prudent about this. He says, because it appears as great deception for a husband to order his wife to pour water over her husband's hands, for the husband is not preferred to her. I'll get back to this word deception in a second. But he says that we don't follow this practice because it's not proper for the husband to order the wife. Now, I was a little surprised because when you read this, it makes no sense at all. We're not prudent about this, for it appears as great deception for a husband to order his wife to pour water over her husband's hands. What does that mean, deception? I'm a little surprised because he should have seen that this didn't make any sense. He should have asked someone. The words in the Aruch HaShulchan don't say deception. It says ramut ruach. That doesn't mean deception. That means haughtiness. So now let me read it to you. We are not prudent about this, for it appears as great haughtiness for a husband to order his wife to pour water over her husband's hands. So that's a mistake that he made. And the way he translated it, the word ramut, he connected it to the word for deception, which sounds a little similar, but that's not what it means. And it's not a completely unusual expression either. Despite this, I found good insights. Let me just read you some more I marked off, dealing with the Aruch HaShulchan, beginning on page 64 of his book. He discusses the Aruch HaShulchan's view on women's obligation on lighting Hanukkah candles. The Aruch HaShulchan says that women have the same obligation as men, but he says, I never heard of a custom where women light candles. And that in reality, the father lights for the entire family. Fishbane contrasts this to the Aruch HaShulchan. The Aruch HaShulchan says women don't light for themselves, for they are tefelot to men. He translates inferior to men. Again, it's tefelot here does not mean inferior. It means like they are I wouldn't even say secondary, but they are like included in the men. So they're not at that level of the men because they're included. But here and he says then in the Bir Halacha, he says that women should not lay for the families, for a curse on a man whose wife and children bless for him. So he's contrast the Aruch HaShulchan, who is neutral, with the Mishnah Berurah, who has like a negative view on this matter about women doing this. So he sees the Aruch HaShulchan as more open-minded, more modern, if we could use that term about women. I'll only add that Ramosha Feinstein said that, at least where he was in Europe, all women did light Hanukkah candles. I asked a friend of mine in Lakewood, and he says he's never seen really women lighting if their husbands light. But that's what Ramosha says. On page 65 and 66, he has another example. He calls the realistic approach of the Aruch HaShulchan. He repeats again the thing about checking for bread, checking for chametz, but then he quotes what the Aruch HaShulchan says, that our women check even better than the men. But then he quotes the Mishnah Berurah in section 437, Sifkat 18. This is what the Mishnah Berurah says. Nevertheless, it is preferable that one not order the women to inspect for chametz, for it is a lot of work, and we must be concerned that they will be lazy. So here you have the Mishnah Berurah holding the old approach of the women being lazy and the Aruch HaShulchan adopting the new approach. On pages 69 to, on, oh, pages, oh, sorry, 66 to 67, he deals with the famous case, the Aruch HaShulchan and davening in front of a woman with uncovered heads. The Gemara tells us that Seir is erva in a woman, and you can't daven in front of erva. Well, the Aruch HaShulchan famously says that today, so many women go around now with bare heads. I think, by the way, he's referring to women in general. Non-Jewish women also used to wear, think of the babushkas with their head covering. So he says, since the women are always going around now bareheaded, no one's really attracted by hair. It's not a distraction. Therefore, there's no difference between unmarried women who go about with uncovered heads, and there's no problem. That's not considered erva. And married women, therefore, there's no sinful thoughts, and you can pray in front of them. I mean, he's not referring only, unless I'm misinterpreting it. I mean, he doesn't say this. He's not referring to Jewish women per se. What does it matter, Jewish women, non-Jewish women? It's the hair. If you see hair all the time, if the Jewish women cover their hair and non-Jewish women don't cover their hair, what's the difference? Hair is hair. At least that's how I always understood it. This Aruch HaShulchan has often been misinterpreted. It's amazing how many that people assume that he's coming up with a big limud tzchus to permit married women, because they were starting to uncover their hair at this time, and married women to uncover their hair. There were limud tzchus. I mentioned it in my last book. Examples is the Ben Ish Chai even says that he doesn't really know how to refute the fact that the women in Europe are going uncovered heads. I mean, there are people, the Rabbi, the Yad HaLevi, and others, but they understood it all about nakedness. And if it's now generally done, it's not considered nakedness. However, the Aruch HaShulchan is not adopting that position. He's adopting the traditional view that it's not nakedness with regard to an outsider in terms of davening in front of it. It doesn't arouse sinful thoughts, but it's still nakedness regarding the woman per se. So she is not allowed to be uncovered, even if other people are not enticed by it or anything. Now, this is an example, though, Fishbane says, and I think he's correct, of recognition of the era of willingness to change the accepted halacha in accordance with the reasons of the halacha, whereas the Mishnah Brewer, on the contrary, he says as follows: even if it is the normative behavior of women in the same location to go with uncovered hair in public, as do the wanton ones, it is forbidden. So the Mishnah Brewer doesn't change it and keeps it that way. Rav Moshe Feinstein cites this Aruch HaShulchan. It becomes a very important Aruch HaShulchan, but often misquoted. He says, as Fishbane says, Rabbi Epstein was prepared to recognize that halacha cannot be removed from social reality. He therefore incorporated his worldview into his adjudicative procedure and was prepared to take into consideration the reality that many married women appear in public with uncovered hair. Now that I think of it, I'm going to take back what I said. I think it's I was wrong. I think the issue is Jewish women, not women as a whole, because I just thought of this as I'm reading this. After all, if hair is hair, how does hair magically become erva when someone gets married? It's only erva because the halacha says it's erva, and no one ever said, at least I shouldn't say no one, in the Ashkenazic world, because if you look at the Rambam, he does say this, but in the Ashkenazic world, they never said it was an issue to daven in front of unmarried women's hair. So just like there's no issue of davening in front of unmarried women's hair, there shouldn't be any issue davening in front of a non-Jewish woman's hair. But again, you have to then explain, it seems problematic why all of a sudden, if hair is hair, there's no difference between an unmarried woman's hair and a married woman's hair, unless you want to say that precisely because a Jewish woman's mar a married Jewish woman kept her hair uncovered, seeing this uncovered hair and the uncovered hair dafka of a married woman is what's enticing. Yes, that's the pshat. That's what's enticing. But now, if all the married women have uncovered hair, well, then there's nothing enticing about married woman's uncovered hair. It's just like unmarried hair. That's the pshat. Of course, you could challenge this and say that, well, but there's still some married women whose hair is not uncovered, and therefore that should be enticing. So you shouldn't make the change. But that's what he's saying. I take back what I said before. Now that I think about it, it's only Jewish women married here. Let's go forward. Pages 69 and 70. Another example he offers. Again, these examples are to show you that the Aruch HaShulchan is willing to adapt halacha to what he sees as changes in the environment, the outside environment, because the halacha at its basis was dependent on a different, as we say, mitzius. He talks about men and women, about kiddush, Friday night. Can a woman say kiddush for a man? He says that He says that there's no concept of zila milta. It's not disgraceful for a man to hear a woman's kiddush. He says that only applies in a public ceremony, like for a woman to read the Megillah for a man. He says that I mean, technically, there shouldn't be a problem with a woman reciting kiddush for a man, and not only that, it should be preferable, perhaps, because the man is already sort of recited it in shul, and you could see it's Mitzrayim, etc. But he says that no, he says we still go by the tradition, but he rejects the idea that it's disgraceful. He has other reasons, and he explains it. So that's Fishbane sees that as another example. The final example he gives is on pages 70 to 71. The Mishnah Brura speaks about why women are not obligated in counting. Well, the issue of counting Sefirot HaOmer, and that gets into the question of mitzvah as von grama. He says, the Mishnah Brura says that the minhag is that women don't count at all, and then he quotes a sefer, the Shulchan Shlomo, that says women shouldn't make the bracha. Even if they want to make the bracha, they shouldn't, because in any event they're going to make a mistake, and in general they don't know the meaning of the words. And Fishbane summarizes, a woman, he suggests, does not have the intellectual ability to count accurately or the education to understand a blessing. Again, I think I wouldn't say that. That's not what he's saying, that they don't have the intellectual ability to count accurately. He says they will err in counting. That doesn't mean they don't have the intellectual ability. I'm going to be honest now, and I don't think I'm embarrassed to say it, but until the invention of me getting the, I'm often out of the minyan at night, and Scranton, I'm at home with taking care of the kids, until the invention, I don't know how many years ago, that I got an email telling me to count that night. There were numerous times when I didn't remember to the following morning. It's not about when he says that they're going to err, they're not in shul. In a small shtetl in Poland, you go to davening every night, basically, unless you're traveling as a merchant somewhere. But if a woman's not going to shul, so of course she's going to forget it. She's going to make a mistake. That's not. It's not the intellectual ability. Even women before Beis Yaakov, even the so-called ignorant women in Europe knew how to count. He does say that that they shouldn't be relied on to count, and therefore you don't want them making a bracha because they're going to end up not doing it properly. But what does the Aruch HaShulchan say? He just says that the women are exempt from counting because it's mitzvah seishas zman grama, but they have the custom to bless and count. So he says they do have the custom to bless and count, similar to all positive laws dependent upon time, such as shofar, sukkah, and lulav. I have never seen a community that women count, or for that matter, make the bracha and count, and yet please write in if anyone knows differently. And the Mishnah Berurah says that they don't. It's the minhag not to. But the Aruch HaShulchan is telling us that where he lived in Nevardik, that was the minhag. So I think that's really interesting. Finally, at the end of Fishbane's book, he has appendix, a graphologist report. We have the handwriting of the Aruch HaShulchan, and he has a two-page graphologist report. I was quite surprised to see this because, as far as I know, graphology is regarded as a pseudoscience. And when you read this, it seems like it to me. The writer, namely the Aruch HaShulchan, has an interesting combination of opposites between his external and internal expression, where the external shows modesty, shyness, and a desire to remain out of the spotlight, whereas the internal expression shows tremendous stability, a very wide range of knowledge, and a very high level of spirituality, etc. The writer is full of power and energy, but he utilizes these only intellectually, etc., etc. And it goes on for 2 pages. He is unceasingly involved in spiritual matters. He has very great willpower. He shows diligence and the ability to stick to a goal. This, to me, is of no value. A person with an intellectual and cold approach to life rather than an emotional and warm one. How can one know any of this stuff from the way from a person's handwriting? And yes, that's what graphology is. But as I said, as far as I know, it's regarded as a pseudoscience. Already we've seen examples, and not only, and I see it as a pseudoscience, therefore I say that Fishbane should not have included a pseudoscience, that sort of stuff, in a book that has value, include what I believe to be nonsense. And I've never, ever seen that before in a scholarly work. We've seen already how the Aruch HaShulchan is melamed zchus. He tries to find justifications for practices. And that's really a big theme in him. I mean, this has been known for a long time. It was pointed out also by Chaim Soloveitchik in his article on the change of rupture and reconstruction. Let me just give you a couple of examples, famous examples. We all know that you can't play music on Shabbos. It's not that I'm not talking about electric music, just to take a flute and play it. It's not because there's something technically forbidden, but this is a rabbinic gezeirah. The problem was that with the rise of chazanos, you had the tuning fork. So is that what is that permitted or is that forbidden? And the standard approach is that it's forbidden. The problem was that the chazanim started doing it. It became very popular among the chazanim in Eastern Europe, and they didn't see the problem. Now the Mishnah Brura. When the Mishnah Brura deals with this, this is in Siman Shin Lamed Chet, he simply says, Lashmia kol b'kli, that's he's talking about the tuning fork, kamortan, he calls it, pshita da'asar, d'klei sheir hu, v'gam ha'mechuvah l'sheir. It's obvious that it's forbidden, not even a discussion. But the Aruch HaShulchan, as one who's interested in being Melamed Zchus, if he can, he has a very different approach. This is also in Siman 338. He says, "Bavanoseinu harabim, due to our many sins." He says, "For decades now, this problem has spread with the chazanim that they hold in their hand the mazleg katan of kesef, the tuning fork, and when they stand before the Amud on Shabbos and Yom Tov, they use it. So they get the right tone and they put it between their teeth." And they can hear it, and this—they know how to do the proper song. And this is Mama. She says Klei Shir. He says this is an instrument, and yet they're all doing it. So do you just say it's forbidden, like the Mishnah Brura says? But no, he tries to find some justification. He says perhaps they're doing it, and since they're doing it, perhaps we can say that it's not forbidden because he's the only one that hears it. And it's just for a second. And the whole point of it is to allow you to sing better, and singing is not forbidden. That is, you're not playing, it's not like you're playing an instrument for the purpose of playing an instrument to make sound so people can dance or something. You're just playing it so that you could sing better, and it's only for a second. And maybe the rabbis, their gezeirah was never on this. I mean, it's a good svara, but he never would have come up with that svara had there not been the fact that the people were doing it. The Chazani never asked the question. They just did it. And the Aruch HaShulchan doesn't want to say that they're sinners. In general, you never want to say that the Jewish people are sinners. But it's even more problematic to say the Chazanim are sinners because we know that a Chazan has to be at a high level. He's a representative of the community. And you're not supposed to have sinners as the Chazan. So if you say that the Chazan's Mechal Shabbos, Mechal Yom Tov, how can he still be the Chazan? So it creates enormous problems to conclude that the Chazan is not being proper. We had an issue in one of the shuls in my town where someone who's a very good Chazan, he would have a beeper on him, or actually then it used to be a beeper than a phone or something, because he worked in a profession where he'd be getting calls, and he said it was pikuach nefesh because he had to approve certain insurance for certain treatments that he said could save people's lives. And other people protested. They thought that, fine, you want to do that, but we don't think it's pikuach nefesh, and you shouldn't be standing up on the bima. So you see how this creates issues. And then he goes on. He says, we have to. It's like a. It's vital to try to be melamed zchus, to try to find some justification. Ki chalila lomar shekal Yisrael yichshu be'isra shavus. He says, God forbid to say that the Jewish people, by which he means the general chazanim, are sinning in this matter in a rabbinic prohibition. When they're not just sinning, that's all reason enough to find Bilam Shlosh if you can, but they're the ones standing up as the chazanim. And So he's not happy with it, but he's malamed tzchus. He finds a justification for it. Now, incidentally, he adds something else at the end of this siman, dealing with the tuning fork. And this is, I don't know why he puts it in the brackets in the Rashi script, but then he gets to another matter that the Chazanim were due, which has become the great object of hate since my youth until today, namely the repetition of words, especially in Shmona Esrei. But it's got to be now throughout all davening. Many of you listening here or on tape later, or my age and older, especially if you came from the modern Orthodox world, you remember very well the repetition of words, not just the repetition of words, the skipping of words. You say shom rei shabbos, which is not so problematic as they would say kavodo ma'ale ma'ale olam kavodo. That sort of that skips in words in the middle. But is this permitted, repeating words? There are certain places where they repeat words and they're never going to change it. For example, in Basel, Switzerland, they've been repeating words, the Chazanim, for probably 175 years now. So no one's going to change that. But it is problematic halachically, and it's problematic. You have the issue of hefsek, you have issues that it's sort of, it turns davening into like a show. But the real issue is in matters like with Shema, the brachos of Shema, and Shmona Esrei, where you have hefsek. So what does the Aruch HaShulchan say? I don't know. If any of you go to a shul today where they allow repeating, I even in my shul, there's even, they basically got rid of repeating in Aleinu. Ushmo, Ushmo, Ushmo echad. I mean, repeating words is definitely out. But what does the Aruch HaShulchan say? He says that which they repeat words and they repeat it and they do it three times so that they can do it in accordance with the tunes. He says, Kol yirei Elokim mitztarim bazeh. All God fearers, this troubles them. I don't. He's not referring to something like Ein Kel Keinu or Adon Olam. He's referring to something as part of the regular davening when you're not allowed to talk, and certainly Shmoneh Esrei. He says, however, they can't protest. Ein bi'adam limchos. The rabbis, the pious people, can't protest because the Hamon, they don't want to listen. They want to hear the Chazanim. Ve'ein shomim bazel divrei chachamim. They're not listening. There was a time when the rabbis could say things and the masses didn't listen. It's hard today to imagine the rabbi getting up and saying it's forbidden, we can't do it. The masses don't listen to the rabbis when they speak about other matters, but when we speak about halacha, we're actually in a better situation today than we were years ago when the rabbis would give halacha and the people won't listen either. They say, you work for us. I've mentioned it many times in Italy and other places, the rabbis couldn't even put people in chayrim without the community giving permission. But the masses won't listen. Why not? Because the masses say, Bamram Shazel, let's have Oneg Shabbos, Oneg Yom Tov. Because that to them is Oneg Shabbos, to listen to a good chazan, and to be a good chazan, you have to repeat words. I still remember when I was in high school, and we had someone in my class. This is, I can even tell you who the Rebbe was, Michael Parnas, who, if any of you know Rabbi Michal Parnas, and he made some negative comment about repeating words in davening. And one of the kids in the class, his father was a chazan, and he said to me later that he doesn't understand, the Rebbe doesn't understand what he's talking about. The whole idea of chazonus, you need to repeat words. And all the people saying you can't repeat words don't know what they're talking about. And and Rabbi Bleich, in his article on this in Knebrach Problem, speaks about chazonim who try to show off their voice. And this friend of mine was very offended because his father was a chazon. And he says it's there's nothing to do with showing off your voice. It has to do with making a beautiful song and davening to Hashem. But then he says, so the people won't listen. So what does the Aruch HaShulchan do? He could say, it's forbidden, but no. He says as follows. He says, "V'ulai be'emes ein isur bazeh." Maybe there really is no prohibition in this matter. And he says, "It's good for us l'lamed zchus banu al zera kodesh." He says it's good for us to try to be l'lamed zchus on holy people. In other words, you don't want to have the Jews who are pushing this. They want us to have the repetition of words. We don't want to say they're sinners because they're holy people. And if we can, look, if we can't, we're going to say they're sinning. and try to change them, push them. If we can't do it, maybe the next generation will do it. But if we can try to be Melamed Tzchus, that's what we try to do, and that's a common trend of him. So how can you be Melamed Tzchus? He says, because what do Chazal tell us? They say in the Gemara, I think it's a Mishnah actually, Mishnah. Shema Shema Meshakim Oso. If people say Shema twice, you silence them because it could mean that they're speaking to two different gods. You know, the Zoroastrian idea or something else. Shema Minah the Meshari Tevos Leislan Ba Im Kofim Meshalshim. But the fact that Chazal stressed that you don't say Shema Shema twice. Well, that implies that there's no problem in repeating the other words. You want to say Yismachu, Yismachu twice? That's not a problem. And don't tell me, by the way, he doesn't mention this, but don't tell me it's a hefsek, because we already know some people think that it's a hefsek. We know that in many nuschaos have piyutim and krovitzes and all these things in Shemona Esrei. How could you do that? It's a hefsek. This question was raised, and the answer been given already from Rishonim. It's not a hefsek. Because if it has to do with the davening, if it's part of the davening, it's not a hefsek. So if you tell me that repeating the words are necessary for good kavana, to get people to enjoy the davening, connected to the tefillos and all that, that's not a hefsek, because it has to do with anything that has to do with what you're doing is not a hefsek. We all know you don't talk between washing, at least Ashkenazim, Sfaratim do talk, I found. But if you have to ask for the salt or something, it's not a hefsek because it's relevant. So the same thing would be about hefsek. He says, Ain lanu omar baze tam iser baror. He says, I can't say that it's actually forbidden to repeat a word. Now he doesn't, and Rav Moshe Feinstein, by the way, concludes the same thing, that technically you can't really say it's forbidden unless you skip words, you don't go in the orders. But if you're just repeating the same word, that technically is not forbidden. It's mechuar, it's a bad thing to do, but it's not forbidden. And how does he end the Aruch Shulchan? He says, better let them continue do it. It's better that they remain unwitting sinners, even though technically he just says it's not technically a sin, but it's a bad thing. He says, better that they unwittingly do the bad thing than not. And this would apply, I think, today. If you're stuck in a community, an old-fashioned community, and the rabbi sees that if he pushes this issue, the community's going to fight back and it's going to create a problem. The Aruch HaShulchan says that you're allowed to let them keep doing it. Maybe in the next generation, their children will be better educated. You can explain it to them that it's not the best thing to do. The only one who I know who argues that it's a good thing to do and really has a positive view is Rabbi Leon Modner. In his response to Zikne Yehuda, he doesn't see any problem with it, and he himself was a cantor, so he was attuned to that. Then he said that I want to call your attention. Oh, well, why do, okay, first of all, why does the Aruch HaShulchan justify communal practice? Unlike the Mishnah Berurah, who is more tied to the text. In this book, it's a very big book. You see how thick this is? It's called Darche Daniel. This is the Sefer Yovel, the Jubilee volume for Professor Daniel Sperber. There is an article here called, where is it? Yes, by Levi Yitzhak Cooper, who's written lots of very interesting stuff. He's from Australia and Israel now, was written both in English and in Hebrew. Really wonderful stuff. I quoted extensively in a previous blog post, I'll say this because we're coming up to Pesach also, about the Hasidic practice of not eating a kazayis. We spend so much time eating a kazayis. Do you know that there are certain Hasidim who refuse to eat a kazayis? Of Mara on Pesach, and he's a very nice article on this. So he has an article, Haminhag Baruch HaShulchan v'Haminhag Mishneh Berurah, comparing and going through many examples about Minhag in the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishneh Berurah, and he raises this question: why was the Aruch HaShulchan more apt to justify communal practice? This is on page 307, and he says that perhaps the Aruch HaShulchan was in a more traditional environment that didn't really feel threatened by he was. By the secular tendencies, whereas the Chafetz Chaim was at the forefront of religious politics, that he was more attentive to that. I don't know if that's true. He gives another example. He says that I would say that maybe because the fact that the Aruch HaShulchan is a communal rav, that's the real example. He gives that as the third reason. He says the Aruch HaShulchan is a communal rav. As a communal rav, you have a responsibility to, you feel you have a responsibility to defend the practices if you can. If you're just someone writing a halacha work, you're not really invested. You don't have to deal with the masses. You write your opinion, and that's the end of it. If you're a communal rav, you're the one who has to tell them what to do, and therefore you're more apt to try to justify it if you can. He does wonder who is in his second reason. He talks about, well, maybe one posek is more brave and revolutionary, and the other is more conservative. Who's the more conservative? He quotes Fishbane, says that the Aruch HaShulchan is the more brave posek because he's changing things, and the Chafetz Chaim is more traditional. But the other approach, he says, just the opposite, that it's the Aruch HaShulchan who's more of the traditionalist because he's keeping the old practice and he's justifying the minhag kavua, and the Chafetz Chaim is really the brave one and the one breaking new ground because he is uprooting practices that were traditional. That's how I understand it. It's true that Fishbane cites examples where the Aruch HaShulchan shows himself, attuned to modernity and putting in new ideas. But general, the whole phenomenon of Limud Tzchus shows you we're dealing with a traditionalist posek, and the Mishneh Berurah is not really as tied to the texts. He gives just another example that he gives. We'll go. I have probably about 5 more minutes, so we'll keep going if I go after 10. Deal with Erevin. Erevin is a big issue. What's is how to make a kosher Erev in cities? The Chazon Ish is said to have quipped as follows: that he's never seen a non-kosher mikveh, and he's never seen a kosher Erev. So what does he mean by that? Basically, because a mikveh, they say, the people who do mikvahs say that to have a baseline kosher mikveh is very easy. And all we do, we have various hidurim and everything. So everyone tries to add on to it. But the basic mikveh, not difficult. So the Chazon Ish, every mikveh I see is kosher. On the other hand, to have a kosher Eruv, we have to rely on all sorts of leniencies and bend over because the baseline, Psaki's saying, is that you shouldn't have it. The only reason you can have it is because of kulas. Whereas when it comes to the mikveh, the baseline halacha is that these are all kosher mikvahs. We just try to add more by adding in chumras and hidurim. And this is a big machlokas going back, going back many hundreds of years, but it really became a big issue in the 19th century. It has to do with. In a what does it mean? 600,000 going through it. I don't want to get into the whole details. It's the Mishkanos Yaakov, as I recall, with the lenient position. In any event, the Aruch HaShulchan says as follows, and this is one I want to call your attention to. We don't need to get into the details of Erevin, but look what he says. He goes into detail and he explains the difficulty of the view that would permit Erevin in our cities today. It's relying on a lenient opinion. You could say a das yachid, but then he says, nevertheless, what good is all this detailed discussion I'm having? Because we see that Erevin have spread around for hundreds of years. He says, based on this understanding, and then he says, it seems as if a bat kol, a voice from heaven, has come out that. The halacha is in accordance with. Here he's actually speaking about Tzuras HaPesach. He's not speaking as the tzur, using a Tzuras HaPesach. He says that. No, sorry. You can use a Tzuras HaPesach if you regard a certain area as a karmelis, not as a Rosh Hashanah. But to regard it as a karmelis, we rely on a lenient opinion. But the Aruch HaShulchan says it's as if heaven has declared that this is the proper opinion, and if we come to reject this. Not only won't they listen to us, Eretz Nira Kemishtagim, they'll see that we're crazy people. Even Ramosha Soloveitchik, who didn't hold of all these Erevin, he had a stringent opinion. When he was Rav in Chasovich, and Rasayim beforehand, but I say Chasovich in particular, because we know they had an Erev there, because Rav Soloveitchik himself checked the Erev on Friday. Checked an Erev that, according to his father, was not really, shouldn't have been put up. But since that was the halacha, since that was the accepted halacha, even though the briskers do not hold of it, and as the community rav, he had to check the Erev and had to make sure the Erev was up, even though according to his shita, It wasn't allowed. So what is he going to do? He's going to say you can't have an Erev, just like the Aruch Shulchan says. Not only won't they listen, but you'll be appear to them as if you're crazy. Shadover Zeni Pashet Yisrael, because this has become standard. That is a good example of how the minhag, the standard minhag, is accepted, and the Aruch HaShulchan is not about to come reject something which is generally accepted. And then he says, listen to this. Mitzvah v'chovah l'lam mitzchus al-kol Yisrael. L'chein samti et libi l'ham tzieze heter. He says, we're obligated to try to justify that which religious Jews do. And then Cooper points out, if you look at the Mishnah Berurah, he says that it appears from the Shulchan Aruch that it's forbidden, but he says we don't have the koach l'mchot b'yad ha'somcha al de'azo. We don't have the strength to protest. But abal nefesh should be machmir. And what Cooper points out is that there's a big difference between saying that abal nefesh should be stringent and saying that a bat kol came out to say that this is the halacha. Aruch Shulchan has already accepted the fact that even if it may be difficult halachically to justify it, since everyone does it, the bat kol has decided, God has decided, as it were, that this opinion is correct, and therefore we're not going to question it, and he doesn't even say be stringent, whereas the Chafetz Chaim, he also recognizes we can't fight against it, but leaves room there for stringency and advises people who want to be pious not to rely on the Eruv. Another example, Cooper cites this, deals with, between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishnah Berurah, deals with Arba Kanfos, Talis Katan. Is there a shear for tzitzis? And growing up, we were always told that you have to have 18 by 18, which is the smallest shear of to wear a Talis Katan. Now, we know that in Europe, there are people who wore Talis Katan much smaller. So what to do about this? The Mishnah Berurah says, that which people take beged katan and they make tzitzis, ein yotzim bazakach of a tzitzis. They don't fulfill the mitzvah at all. Umavad shemavatlin mitzvah tzitzis and rachet bracha v'tola. They're not fulfilling the mitzvah, they make a bracha v'tola b'chol yom, every day. They say Hashem's name in vain. And he says also, asur l'seis bo b'shabbos. So that you can't even go walk with this on Shabbos, because you're not wearing it for a beged, you're wearing it for another reason, so you're carrying on Shabbos. What does the Aruch HaShulchan say about this? Again, we're talking about people who are doing this. He says, Kol chakira zo b'chinam. He says there's no need to investigate this matter, about the size of the tzitzis. Why? And he says that the people observe all the whole world, the oilam. He says, Holam mekami mitzvah tzitzis with the small tzitzis. And then he says, the small talis katan underneath your garment doesn't need a shear at all. If it has arba kanfos, it's enough. Since the olam is mekayim, the mitzvah tzitzis, then we don't need to, everyone does it this way. We're not going to uproot it. As long as we can find some justification that you don't need to wear, you don't need to have a shear, that's enough. We're going to accept the way people do it. The Tzitz Eliezer deals with the same thing. In Eretz Yisrael is the same matter. And he quotes Rashi Pesach Frank as saying that you don't need a shear in it. Why people started wearing it so small, who knows? But once they're doing it, then Aruch HaShulchan sees it as his responsibility to justify it. There are exceptions. The Aruch HaShulchan don't think he's always justifying minhag. No, not at all. There are some examples. Cooper cites, there were people who, believe it or not, there are people in Lithuania who during the 9 days would eat meat. We know that's a minhag, it's not halacha. What's the halacha? Erev Tisha B'Av. But they would eat meat. So what would you expect the Aruch HaShulchan to do? Well, the Cooper's point is that you might expect the Aruch HaShulchan to justify this. But I don't know, because if it's different. If all the Jews, or most of the Jews, I should say, are eating meat, then maybe he'll be Mohammed Tzchus. But he doesn't say that. He says, B'avonoseinu harabim kama shemazalzalim. There are some who are mazalzal in it. Okay, so then he says, this is, nevertheless, despite these mazalzalim, the Gemara says, And even though the Gemara says it's not a halacha, only from Erev Tisha B'Av, nevertheless, Kfar Kibo Avosenu Zeh, Harbei Meos B'Shanim, the minhag is to abstain from meat, and therefore these people are wrong. But again, I don't know if this is here. Obviously, he's upholding the minhag. I'd like to see their own example of where there is general disregard of a minhag, and the Aruch HaShulchan is not Malam Mitzchus. If there was general disregard of this minhag, then he could maybe do Malam Mitzchus. The as far as I know, well, the Sfaradim only do it Shavu Shechabo, and I think the Yemenites, if I'm not mistaken, the Yemenites don't have this minhag at all. I know they don't have Sfira. I think they don't have this either. But he says only some. So if only some are being mezalzel on the minhag, that's I don't think it's such a big deal. And finally, or two more things. The Aruch HaShulchan speaks about ball playing on Shabbos. And he says technically it's permitted. If you look in Rabbi Saul Berman's famous article on ball playing, it appeared in the first Eidah journal, as I recall, or the second. He cites this. The Aruch HaShulchan does say that people who do this are having, he calls it a dat shefela. That's it's a very bad thing to do, but he can't say technically it's forbidden. Again, people will be playing ball. And the last halachic point of the Aruch HaShulchan I want to mention to you, I just found it two Shabbosim ago when I was reading a tshuva of Sephardic Rav. And the question is about using a blind person with a walking stick. And already the Shulchan Aruch says that it's in Shin Aleph and Or Chaim, you can't go, a blind person can't use a walking stick because he can walk without a walking stick. And the point of the walking stick is just to assist him so he goes straight. The Achronim derive from this that if you can't, really can't walk at all, then this is like essential to you, then you can use it. The Aruch HaShulchan says that what the Shulchan Aruch says, you can't, a regular blind person can't use a walking stick, that's only if he knows his way. And he only takes it in order to keep his steps straight. But if he can't walk, then obviously he's allowed to use it because he might fall in a pit. So here you see the Aruch HaShulchan expanding again on the, it's not there, there's other Achronim who say it as well, but since the Aruch HaShulchan says it very nicely, that you know, when you walk out today, there could be pits, you could fall, therefore you can use it. And this machaber, this is Pinchas Toledano, he's the chief rabbi of Amsterdam, he says certainly today when there's a special walking stick and everyone knows that what it's for, and this is like you know, a candle in the dark for them, because in the big cities especially it's very hard. So there's no problem with using, and he says even the Shulchan Aruch would permit it today. Okay, so with that, we come to the close. I have a few more things I want to say before we end, just to get them on the tape. But we come to the close of the classes on the Aruch HaShulchan, six classes. As I've said before, I could have done many, many more classes, but we have to make an end to it. I want to thank all the people who commented. I'll get to the questions in a second. And the people who commented, who sent in questions, who corrected me on occasion. I learned a lot preparing the classes and speaking them. And I don't know if you sense this, but I can tell you that a lot of what I say is off the cuff. It's not what I'm reading. I have some basically Rashi Prakim little notes. But not only that, often I come to conclusions and I say things that I derive as we're doing it. I mean, today was the idea of the hair covering. But much of that is what I'm doing. So if I apologize if sometimes I seem to be meandering because I'm actually thinking about it on the spot. Okay, well, before I get to the questions, just a couple things. One thing relevant to last class, we spoke with Rabbi Zilberstein, and one of the listeners texted me that I should look at this website, the Yeshiva World, because the Yeshiva World has had a thing about the, I was speaking about Ilhan Omar. So lo and behold, the Yeshiva World had a thing about Naturei Karta that went down to defend Ilhan Omar last week. So I went to Yeshiva World. I saw that article. Obviously, it was disgraceful, but we know who these people are for a long time. But right next to that article, there was another article. Here it is. Bizayon HaTorah, the gevir, that is the wealthy man who gave tzedakah by making Bachrim jump into ice-cold swimming pool. So the Gaon Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, Shlita Marad Asra Ramat Ochanan B'nai Brak, told the story that happened in America. Happened now in the winter. Six yeshiva Talmudim went to America, decided they're going to assist their yeshiva raising money. They went to a gvir, a wealthy person with the ability to write a substantial check. The response of this philanthropist was somewhat bizarre, telling the Bacharim that for each one of them willing to jump into his ice-cold swimming pool, fully clothed, the yeshiva will receive $1,000. The Bacharim did not hesitate, and all six jumped in with their clothing on. The gevir was good to his word, writing out a check to the yeshiva in the promised amount of $6,000. The proud Bacharim submitted the money to the yeshiva, and when the administration learned of how they got the donation, the yeshiva decided to tear up the check, which they feel was earned by denigrating Torah, albeit with good intentions. Rav Zilberstein rule addressed the question if the gevir is required to write out another check. He ruled after much pilpul regarding the shaila that the gevir did not have to repay the $6,000 tzedakah because it was not a donation but a disgrace. And Yeshiva World titles this Bizayon HaTorah. Now, obviously, anyone with any sense knows that the story never happened. It's a phony story. There never were six yeshiva bachrim told by a gevir to jump in the swimming pool. Whoever heard, as one of the comments on this, of who has a First of all, you could die. Well, I'll read what he says, but no one has water in their pool. The story never happened. And yet, the yeshiva world assumes it assumed it did happen, and as a whole thing, that it's a great bizayon. And if you read the comments, almost all the comments are speaking about that the different bizayon haTorah. You know, they compare it to the bucket challenge, and at least one of them says that the gevir will no doubt find other deserving causes, and the good rabbi from Bnei Brak is not going to be one of them. Talking about how this is disgrace, how they do, this gevir is denigrating Torah. Someone says no less a bizayon haTorah than yeshivas raising funds via bingo or gambling. Someone says maybe it's bizayon haTorah to send the boys collecting money. Et cetera, et cetera. Only a couple of the comments know that the whole thing is made up. I was shocked. One guy writes, Shlomo, to those who doubt the story was made up, nobody has an ice-cold swimming pool. When the weather gets ice-cold, people's swimming pools drain them. Not only that, but jumping into literally ice-cold water will cause hypothermia and death within minutes. And then someone else says, Rabbi Zilberstein quotes the Ben Ishchai in the introduction to one of his Sfarim that we can create an imagined story in order to impart a lesson of halacha. There's a reason why no one in America has heard this bizarre story, which is said to have occurred here. Then he says his stories are theoretical in order to bring out the halachas in an interesting way. But most people don't get it, don't realize this. The guy right after it says, call a kavod to the yeshiva, which refused the donation, giving to Bachrim, who agreed to jump in the pool. Supporting Torah is a privilege and an obligation, not a gimmick which degrades B'nai Torah. Please post the name of the yeshiva so I can send a donation. Of course, there is no yeshiva. It's all phony. It's all false. And everyone knows that Rav Zilberstein creates these stories because it's a very interesting case. You know, does the gevir, is he obligated now to send, write another check? However, I do want to add one more point about Rabbi Zilberstein, because one of you wrote in and said correctly, it's not only though about these halachic things. He makes up stories which have no relevance to halacha and are just stories. I don't pretend I have an answer to this. We have examples of rabbanim like this in the past. Rav Yudel Rosenberg, the Torah Tamima, and others. The person who wrote in, who's one of the people listening to us, says he finds it very problematic. You know, what about Midrash HaKatir Chak? What about the fact that he creates all these stories that are clearly not true, and anyone can go online now and see that they're not true? What does this do to Masorah? All I can say is I think it's something about his personality that he likes to tell tall tales, he likes to tell stories. And I asked a friend who's in Lakewood, and he said that everyone just smiles when they hear that. They know that these are just, he likes to tell stories. Some people like to tell stories. Stories are made up about Gedolim all the time, and he makes up stories about Gedolim. One of the most famous stories, he's the one who, Reb Chaim Kanievsky, repeated the idea that that Jews have different number of teeth than non-Jews. That's not invented by Reb Zilberstein. That's found in earlier Sefer. But he said that, you know, and there's a dentist in America, he's an anti-Semite, and he looks through people's mouths, and he, when he sees that someone has the amount of teeth for the Jews, he kicks them out because he doesn't want to treat them. So someone asked him, like, where did he get this story from? Obviously a phony story. He says he heard it from Rav Zilberstein, his brother-in-law. So here you have an example of, Rav Zilberstein made up a story like this, that there's this anti-Semitic doctor who looks at if you have the Jew teeth, how he counts the teeth, and if you have the number for the Jews, he won't treat you. And all of his books are full of stories like that. And you're asking me how to explain how an unbelievably great Talmid Chacham has this side of him, which is I don't know, a vivid imagination. I don't know what to say. Someone is going to write a book about it because it's not the typical thing. But and I understand with the halachic stories, he does it for a reason, to create a case that he can then discuss. But with these other stories that he creates and he repeats these stories that he hears, like the person who wrote in told me about the story, like a 9/11 story, so how someone was saved. He forgot his tefillin and he made the plane. Like the plane had to let him off to get his tefillin. So he's repeating stories, but he's also inventing stories. And I have a case that someone showed me where he quotes something from an earlier sefer and he just adds on a whole section to turn it into a miracle story. So I don't have the answer. I can't explain it. But I'm just putting it out there for you. And he's an unbelievably learned Talmid Chacham. So. Moshe says from Lakewood that he thinks that there's a tshuva of the Chafetz Chaim to Rav Meir Shapira of Lublin. Moshe from Lakewood also says it gets even more watered down these days when the incandescent bulb is going the way of the dinosaur. Yeah, it becomes very hard to understand why an LED light is forbidden not only on Shabbos but on Yom Tov. If you can transfer fire from here to there, how can an LED light be more stringent than fire being transferred? So it does become harder. Yes, Moshe points out that the head of Yaakov Lifshitz, who published memoirs and also published a book on Yitzchak HaInspector, he was head of the Black Cell, HaLishkah HaShchora, which would put out all this anonymous Pashkevillim in Kovno and elsewhere attacking the Zionists. And Moshe tells us, for those listening, you can see James Randi debunking a graphologist on YouTube. Hey, if graphology was a real science, we have the handwriting of lots of Gedolim. We have from Rishonim, even the Rambam. We could learn a lot. Bill Gewirtz says repeating words of Psukim like Kadosh, Kadosh, Shabrok, Kavod is problematic. You'd have to explain why that's more problematic. Maybe because you're addressing God and it's like a second God, a third God. But Kavod HaMalayim is a piyut whose repetition is allowed. And you see Rav Schachter agrees with this. Yeah, well, okay, but not, remember, the old way of doing Kavod HaMalayim was Kavod HaMalayim, Ayei Mekom Kavodo. That is a problem, I think, because you're skipping the words. You're saying Rav Schachter permits that. That I can't see, because Rav Moshe says that's forbidden. But if you're just saying Kavod HaMalayim, and then you go on reading the words. There was once in my shul, a chazan who was also a musmach, and I asked him once, this is going back like 30 years ago, when I was a kid, why he repeats. He didn't split the words up, but he would say like male, male, oh, why he repeats the words. And he says because he doesn't see the problem. What's the difference? He's just repeating the same word. If you make a mistake, you can repeat the words. So that's what he said. So you say Bill Gewirtz, this is something new which I didn't know. Rav Schachter agrees. So, but then you have to clarify. Rav Schachter agrees that he agrees technically it's not problematic, like Rav Moshe himself agrees, and the Aruch HaShulchan, or he and as Shas HaDechak, or when the Chazan won't listen, we don't make a big deal about it, or is he agreeing with it that if you ask him, he'd say no problem, go figure out a good nigun to do that. If it's the latter, then that's a big deal because that would be something in today's day and age. Pretty much unheard of. If it's the former, that's the Aruch HaShulchan. And I don't know. Like apparently, what you're saying, the Great Synagogue, they repeat words. Bill says Rav Aaron Soloveitchik did not wear tzitzis on Shabbos because of a concern that some non-practice chumrah is correct, and then tzitzis being worn or carrying. I've never been able to find out whether Rav Joseph B. Soloveitchik, the Rav, wore tzitzis on Shabbos, but I'm told that the Brisker Rav in Jerusalem, and this is not just I'm told, this is recorded again. So do we know it's true? Lots of things are recorded. It doesn't make them true, but at least it's recorded in print that the Brisker Rav did not wear tzitzis in Shon Shabbos. The Brisker Rav of Revelvo, Ritzak Zev Soloveitchik. David Eisen, Rizzo, I spoke about this last week. Rizzo's famous case of the poison sandwich is also made up. Yes, obviously it's made up. All these cases are made up. For those who don't remember, some guy would bring us to work or to school, I think, a sandwich, and another person would constantly steal it. So he made a poison sandwich and put it in there. And then what happens if the person eats it and dies? I think the case was he died. Is that, is the person who put the poison sandwich there responsible? On the one hand, I never told him to eat it. He stole from me. How can I be responsible? On the other hand, I knew he was going to take it. So shouldn't I have responsibility for him killing him? Because, I'm not supposed to kill anyone. This is an example of a clearly made up case, but they're all made up. Every one of his books has one case stranger than the other case. And he tells us in the introduction that the Ben Ish Chai says you can make things up. Yeah, the teeth story goes back to, I believe, the first. There was an article in this journal that came out a few issues called Hapa'amon by these enlightened Hasidim in Borough Park in Williamsburg. And they have a whole article on it. I think the Shevet Musar, it's going back already 300, 400 years, is the first one to speak about non-Jews having different number of teeth than Jews. It's like the sort of thing that they never bother counting. It's like Aristotle thought, what is it, men and women had different numbers of teeth. And here he's sleeping with his wife every night and never bothered to check how many teeth she had. It's a famous quote from Bertrand Russell about this, how the empirical evidence was not really valued then. Forgetting now, and Bill says forgetting his Rav Zilberstein's reliability, his idea of monetary shaylot raised new things to consider. They do. The halachic cases, the rabbi in my shul sometimes will bring up a case that he gives, because the case, like the case I just gave you, and all these other cases, the poison sandwich case is an unbelievable case, because how could I be responsible if someone steals it? I never told him to take it. On the other hand, I had a suspicion. I almost knew he was going to take it, and I poisoned it. So who's responsible? And every one of his cases are like this. They really raise all sorts of incredible questions and really get you working on Talmudic logic. And that's no different than what many people require before smicha. They give them a theoretical case, and you need to have to come up with the answer to that. The Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, as I mentioned last week, to graduate with smicha there, you would have to give you three cases in Or HaChaim. No, actually, Evan Ezra Yardea, and not Or HaChaim, Evan Ezra Yardea and Choshen Mishpat, I believe, were the three areas that give you a theoretical case, and you'd have to write a tshuva about this. So, have I seen the new biography of Rabbi Weinberg? I haven't seen a new biography of Rabbi Weinberg. I've seen a book where they took Rabbi Weinberg's memoirs, basically, throughout all his writings about different great sages. That I have. They sent it to me. Almost nothing is new in there, but it comes from stuff already published. But there are some new things, some stuff from Rav Sternbach and others. So if you're or if you're a Rabbi Weinberg person, you'll want to get that. And Moshe, thank you, points out the tshuva of the Chafetz Chaim is in the Or HaMeir, Siman 3. That's the Meir Shapiro, though he leaves it to Rav Zaks. I don't know what you mean, leaves it to Rav Zaks to write. So you're telling me, and we'll end with this, that Rabbi Zaks writes it saying he's expressing the views of his father-in-law? Is that what he means? I'll wait for Moshe from Lakewood to tell us what that is. Rabbi Zaks, for those who don't know, from the younger generation, his son-in-law, Rav Menachem Mendel Zaks, he was the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim, but from the Chafetz Chaim's old age. But he then comes to America, and horror upon horrors, he's hired and works at Yeshiva University, Yeshiva Zeruz Zachanan, where his job was as the bochei. So I don't know if the family today wants to record that, but that's where he made his parnassa. And when I was a kid, I knew someone from that family who was very involved in. We used to go to Shabbatones in Borough Park. JEP, it was called, Jewish Educational Programs. And I guess it was a granddaughter of Rabbi Zaks, but it's spelled Sacks. But I believe the way, but it's with a Zion Aleph Kuf Samach. So Moshe from Lakewood hasn't answered me. Oh, he has. Okay. Yes, the case of the problematic sandwich. I know Rabbi Blech wrote about it. Moshe tells us Rav David Soloveitcher doesn't wear tzitzis on Shabbos as a brisker. Well, if Rav David doesn't wear it, then that's proof that his father, because his father wore it, he would have wore it. Though says the Rav did, Rav Velvo did not, concern for the Baal HaMor about Tcheles, that the Baal HaMor has to do with Tcheles. And okay, so Moshe says that he left it to Rav Zaks entirely. So I don't know what you're saying then, Moshe. I thought you were telling me that the Chafetz Chaim wrote a tshuva. But now you're saying that he didn't write the tshuva, that he was asked, oh, he was asked a question. That's it. Okay, now I understand what you're saying. He was asked a question, but he didn't write it. But who, it's signed by the Chafetz Chaim? Is that what you're saying? It's signed by the Chafetz Chaim, but Rav Zaks wrote it. I'll end with one tidbit. Since you mentioned the Chafetz Chaim and signing it, I'll take a look at it later. If you look at the beginning of the Mishnah Berurah, you'll see a haskamah, an approbation from the Aderes, Eliyahu David Shabbinetz Te'omim. And the tradition in the family is that Rav Kook wrote this haskamah for the Aderes. The Aderes signed the name. If that's what you mean, Moshe, if I'm going to hang up now, so be email me or I'll, what is that? Or write quickly what exactly you mean. Rav Zaks wrote it, but it's signed by the Chafetz Chaim. But stay tuned. Although this is considered Torah miSinai in the Merkas HaRav world, that the that Rav Kook wrote the Haskamah, the Aderes asked him to write it, and Aderes signed it. I will make the case in a future post, which hopefully I'll be able to get to, that it is not true. I think I have evidence that the Aderes wrote it himself, not Rav Kook. So again, thank you, Rodney. Thank you all, and wish you all a good Purim, and thank you for joining us these past number of weeks.